Birth, Volume 3, The Gathering, Chapter 3. The early shores of the Black Sea were calm, with a warm breeze making the tiny waves fill Boris's mind with some semblance of peace. It was empty here. There was not even a human footprint to be seen as far as he could see to the horizon. The brown sand was coarse with dark granite, brushing gray in layers along the beach. There is no sea close to Almaty, Kazakhstan. The mountains across the vast valleys are a different kind of peace, but somehow water hushing rhythmically against the sloping, silent sand offers a primal tranquility like nothing else on earth. He needed it. In fact, right now he felt like he would never leave it. The money he had brought with him was enough to stay here until, well, until the end of the world. He laughed for a moment while he walked alone, barefooted, along the gray water of this secluded shore. The water was always too cold for tourists, as it was Arctic water being drawn into the Gulf Stream by global tides. But it was full of life, with whales, dolphins, and some of the best fishing in Eastern Europe. He wondered if Almaty, the city of apples, held anything for him. His Sasha was dead. He had abandoned his mission with Kalibnikov and Marina, the team that had built the four nuclear IEDs. The heartless plan had included seducing him with a lust for revenge over his Sasha's murder. He thought about what could have possibly have inspired him to program a disarming feature into the cell phone trigger of those weapons. He shuddered at the idea that Kalibnikov might have detonated them remotely with his own cell phone message to the devices while he was still standing on the roof of the Marriott Hotel in Medina. "Well, at least I would have been with my Sasha," he said to a sandpiper scooting along the sand in front of him. He missed her. Still, he had the patience of a Soviet bureaucrat. He promised to keep her face in his mind, so that if the next cataclysm took him, he would be ready. He wouldn't feed a hatred for Muslims into his dreams. He wanted to be with her again, and if that meant he would harbor good thoughts and look for the good in others, then that is what he would do. And if there was no cataclysm with his name on it, and he had to wait until the higher Earth began drifting through the cosmic birth canal of the Milky Way galaxy, then he would be ready for that too. It was a good moment. He could manage living without her, as long as he rolled each moment over in his mind like a hard candy on the tongue. Unlike the impersonal indifference of a consummate bureaucrat, the heart broadcasted a signal through the cracks in his soul, ever searching for a reply. The shores of Crimea were dotted with warm water ports used for thousands of years by various seagoing peoples. Nearly a decade ago, the Crimean people voted to be annexed by Russia in a most amazing turn of events. The Ukraine is a region of country that had been part of Russia since 1763. Crimea, connected by a narrow isthmus, was a different kind of land with a different culture. His treasured wife, Sasha, was Ukrainian. She had the genetics, that's for sure. Her long, lean body was muscular and carved like an angel. Her jaw was small and square, and her cheekbones were high and round like nobility. Her enormous brown eyes slanted in her face like they were painted by an exotic artist. Her alabaster skin was pure as a bar of soap, and had the feel of velvet. The men of her clan were hard as the stone they mined for iron and gold. They were tall and broad like giants, with a will to be free like no other race on earth. Obstinate and highly intelligent, their communities boiled over twice into Europe, wrestling the entire continent into a war that lasted more than 30 years. Their president was named Yanukovych. The former prime minister served as the fourth president of Ukraine from February 2010 until his removal from power in February of 2014 when a most peculiar chain of events changed everything. The ancient intelligence had mastered and implemented an alchemical plan to capture the whole world in a global snare of endless debt. Nation by nation, they were loaned money by a transatlantic central banking system. When they could not meet the terms of the debt, they forced military bases onto their lands and confiscated their profits from their utilities and natural resources. That process was about to take place in Ukraine as well, as Yanukovych was offered an enormous debt proposal by the central bank, controlled by the notorious, corrupt European Union. Everything was going as planned, and in November of 2014, the European banks had the Ukraine right where they wanted them. They were broke. They needed capital to exploit their mining and material processing industry to expand their exports. Since 1991, financial oligarchs made wealthy by the 30-year war kept their capital out of the economy, starving it of working capital and opting to remain in their castles dug into the mountains here and there along the many scenic rivers of the country. Yanukovych had nowhere to turn except for the central bank for financing. Just as he sat down to sign the national loan papers, which the European Central Bank had promised all along would make them part of the European Union, history took an unexpected turn. Secret Service agents that serve next to every president on Earth stepped out from the shadows and informed Yanukovych of the dark plan awaiting his country. Ukraine would never be allowed open borders to Europe. They were afraid of letting the genetics of Ukraine into the docile community they controlled with choking debt already. The golden solution they offered would be poured down the throat of the country, making it impossible for them to swim against the high interest rates, balloon payments, and a requirement to feed the profits to the top 2% of oligarchs left over from the 30 years war. Within less than a decade, NATO would have its forces snugly installed against the Russian border. And these Secret Service agents were talking to other leaders as well. The shadow of a dark and terrible juxtaposition chilled the room as the phone rang with Yanukovych's hand poised to sign away the life of the country. It was President Vladimir Putin. What people of the day overlooked was that Yanukovych was actually Crimean. He was Russian, just as the people of Crimea are 90% Russian by culture. They speak Russian. They have had open borders with Russia for centuries. So when Putin told Yanukovych that Russia would make the needed loans to them and provide them cheap natural gas for their expansion, the pen was closed and put away. The IMF's death grip through the black glove of the World Bank was avoided, and the Ukraine decided to remain free and sovereign. Boris remembered the fascists of Brussels colluding with the dark forces of President Obama to immediately transport thousands of soldiers and militant protesters into Kiev to burn Yanukovych out of office. For weeks they attacked the government buildings, and the people fought back with everything they had. They used heavy construction equipment as defensive armor and pushed back the armed attackers. Ukrainian men formed human walls and forced troops back with homemade firebombs and bats. Soldiers killed many civilians with bullets, but they would not surrender. The whole plot broke wide open when a uniformed CIA agent was injured and captured by civilian defensive forces. The agent's face and identification was shown to the world via instant video, and within hours, the assault ended. Yanukovych escaped with his life, but the damage was done. The corrupt leader from the previous administration, who was actually serving a prison sentence at the time, was put in place. While the Western puppeteers bolted their tentacle into her arms and her mouth so she could resist Russia's assistance, the press was sent home. The son of the future U.S. Secretary of State, John Kerry, was sent in to seize the country's oil and mining assets as they prepared for the groomed Hillary Clinton to leave office and prepare to be coronated President of the United States by globalist media moguls. The European fascists continue to organize and move their pan-European armies closer to the borders of Russia, until the global tension was almost more than the Balkan nationalists could bear. The marketing plan to maintain a constant state of battle around the world was clever beyond belief. Somehow they convinced the taxpayers of the world to support a war against what they called terror. They moved billions in military hardware within easy striking distance of Moscow, while telling the world that it was a defensive strategy to protect Europe against an attack from Iran. The forces of Semyaza spread around the world in such small units of death and mayhem that no army could find them, let alone fight them. Every few days a bomb would explode, or a gunman would shoot 20 people in a train station, or a nightclub would be riddled with bullets. The strategy numbed the people into an undercurrent of fear that made them watch over their shoulders when they went shopping, or out to eat, or to church. Their children were plagued with nightmares and lost hope for any future of peace or success. Hundreds of millions of people bought guns and practiced weekend after weekend for war, with paper human silhouettes in their own neighborhoods. There was no safe frontier left. There was nowhere to run. There was only the exhale of despair while they sipped their morning coffee and watched the horizon for an army that would never come. But then the earth began to shiver. It reminded Boris of watching a snake while he was very young. When the time came for the snake to shed its skin, it twisted and shivered as it broke loose from its old skin. The spiritual earth was making the same transition. He mused as he watched his bare feet make the sand around his steps shiny with the moisture in the quiet morning sun. The American news lady said, "The body of the righteous and merciful souls, now resonating in a sweeter place of consciousness around the world, was being shaken loose from the world made of metal and stone." That process was slowly loosening Semyaza's grip on the Northern Hemisphere. It was supernatural, to be sure, but it made more sense than anything the global pundits were saying. The Black Sea was far from the deserts of Saudi Arabia, and so was the calm and mesmerizing shore on which he left a single path of footprints, fading with each lick of the tiny waves spilling over them. When the Soviet Union crumbled from within, he felt like his world crumbled with it. But even more than this, he imagined that the victorious capitalists would come over the Zaliski-Alatu mountain range and consume them. It didn't happen. The country drifted into quiet ignominy. He thought about the weeks following his discharge from the Energy Bureau in 1991 and the sudden push by Kazakhs to form a new and sovereign country. In the old days, when the new boss came in with new policies, people would be taken out and shot by the busload or sent off to work in the mines or forests. That didn't happen. Young and educated Kazakhs boldly solicited investment from Wall Street and other sources of capital, brought it home, and began exploiting the vast resources inside their own borders. Mostly, it was good for the country, but there were a few transactions with the familiar stench of death and greed that caked on their boots so thick the country could never quite reach the top of the hill. The Chinese government instructed their industries to hold Kazakhs hostage with high prices for equipment, and then supplied it to themselves for a fraction the cost as they moved in to buy out fledgling companies that were on the verge of something great. Oil fields that had been explored and mapped were only allowed to be partially developed, while the Chinese plotted to fall on them like vultures as soon as petroleum prices fell. Other foreign criminal syndicates bribed the U.S. Secretary of State and Kazakh officials to cheat the country out of its uranium mines and then sell them to their own enemies for personal profits. It was not only frustrating for Kazakhstan, but the American people were helpless to stop Semyaza's crime gang that so brazenly perpetrated its evil. Boris kicked at the sand with bare feet as he thought about the hundreds of millions of dollars that were fed into the American presidential election process from foreign special interests. Their greed was so powerful that it funded and armed ISIS and allowed them to slaughter mercilessly to accomplish their wealth machine. He held the Muslim Brotherhood that operated out of the White House responsible for the death of his precious Sasha, not the Saudi people. They marketed war on every channel in every country and forced people to look over their shoulder every time they went shopping or to the restaurant with their children. It was this political greed that killed his beautiful Sasha. The most powerful economic centers got the worst of it. The American presidency collapsed altogether, and they would have lost their constitution completely if it were not the revolutionary election of Robert Riker. He was glad the reign of the judges was over, and the crime bosses all eventually either killed one another or ended up in prison. He knew in his soul that the planet was about to change. At times, he could almost hear the sound of it. It was like a joyous uproar that is just over the horizon, just beyond the soft crashing waves of the Black Sea. The gray skies of Eastern Europe were beginning to haze out the morning sun as the ever-present breeze from the northwest began carrying the pollution of hundreds of coal-burning power plants and factories out to sea. The gray in his heart was now comfortable. He lowered his head again, and his eyes followed the sandpiper as it searched the rhythmic backwash for food. "Just like you, little bird," he said into the breeze, "I am watching the ground for one more day."